Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Let's bring the Labor and Consumer Protection Division to order. We do have a quorum. A few things today. They like us so much they're putting us on TV.
Thank you. For testifiers, we do want to keep moving along today. We want to have good testimony, but we also want to keep the process moving and start and end on time. So when you do come to the table to testify, please state your name and then also spell it. I think we're having a little hearing problems up here in the chair. If others have testified on the same bill, please do your best not to be redundant, but instead add to or reinforce what they have said. And again, we're looking to start and end on time. We've got a fun day ahead of us. Representative Lane. Good morning and welcome. Representative Simon, would you like to move House File 420?
I will, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 420 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Perfect. Representative Lane?
Yes,
see your bill.
This is a bill to simply take what's in statute now for a homeowner and say it has to be given to them in writing so that they're aware that it even exists. Right now, there's the implied warranty in statute, and they don't receive a natural written warranty, and they can choose to waive their protection. This simply prohibits them waiving it and provides a real warranty and requiring the builder to convey an actual written warranty instrument.
You have a testifier with you.
I do.
Sir, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Dabney Committee, my name is Scott Andreessen. I'm an attorney in the Twin Cities who's represented a few hundred homeowners who have had warranty claims against their builders over the past 8 or 9 years. I'm here to support this bill. I think all it simply does is it requires builders, when they enter into a contract for the sale of a home, to put the text of the statute, the Consumer Protection Warranty Statute, in their contract, such that the homeowner knows what all those requirements are, because there are a litany of requirements in Chapter 327A in terms of what's included and what's excluded, what you need to do in terms of giving notice to the builder if there's ever a problem, and the time frame to do all of that. Most homeowners don't understand that. If they have a problem with their new home, they pick up the phone, they call their builder, say, hey, can you come out and take a look at it? And the builder oftentimes says, sure, but maybe it's going to be a month or two. Maybe it's wintertime in Minnesota. So it takes a few months to get going. Because the homeowner never knew that there are specific deadlines for certain types of notices, they often run afoul of this statute. And this bill would simply require the builder to give them a copy of it in advance when they build the house so that they can then understand what their role is and what their requirements are to meet the statutory warranty.
Representative Lane, unfortunately in my house we're looking at probably having to buy a new dishwasher. I know when I buy it I'll get a whole little plastic bag full of paperwork and I don't know what all else, maybe some free dishwasher detergent. Is the intent that it be similar when I remodel the house, that I get, just like I get a warranty when I buy the dishwasher, I get a written copy of the warranty when I have the remodeling work done or new construction?
Well, my intent has been that people don't even know that these statute books exist. And it's just simply to have it there that there is this warranty is the first step in bringing them to the awareness that they have something.
All right. Thank you. Is questions for the author or the testifier? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify either before or against the bill? Ms. Finette? Welcome to the committee. Please state and spell your name and then continue with your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Frenette. You can spell my last name, F as in Frank, R-E-N-E-T-T-E, Frenette. I'm with the Builders Association of Minnesota. Appreciate the opportunity to get up and speak with you guys. The Builders Association agrees that it's probably a great idea to give the homeowner a copy of the warranty statutes. However, what this bill does that we believe is it makes the implied warranties an express warranty. In your example, Chairman Dabney, of buying a dishwasher and getting a little pamphlet that talks about stuff is an express warranty. And a lot of times an express warranty is, and I use a toaster as an example, you get something that says this is what the company's fault is, and this is what your, or not fault, but your responsibility is, and then this is what your responsibility is. Heaven help that a child doesn't get hurt, but they put a knife in the toaster, and the toaster dies. It's your responsibility. However, if the toaster is not toasting toast, you get to get a free toaster. And we think that if you offer, if we make these express warranties like they do in the title, and by taking out the word statutory, we need to offer something to the homeowner and the builder that offers some sort of guidelines or some sort of handbook that says this is your responsibility and this is the builder's responsibility, to make things a little clearer. And in a home, it can think of this, the foundation of the house is always caulked so that you don't get stormwater running into it. Caulk, however, only lasts so many years, and you need to re-caulk. I have a 100-year-old house. My husband and I re-caulk the house every 4 or 5 years just to make sure we're not getting any stormwater or runoff into the house. A homeowner needs to understand that there's responsibilities out there or guidelines that are actual major construction defects or not major construction defects. And I think if you're going to make this express, we need to offer them something, maybe developed through the Department of Labor and Industry, that offers guidelines as to what is part of an express warranty and what is not.
So for this assignment, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Ms. Burnett, for your testimony. And you and I have talked about this at other times. I support the bill, but I'm intrigued by your idea to have kind of a two-way street there. I'm wondering, you mentioned a couple different options there. Just as food for thought for the future, I don't think it's something that could readily be done today because it's a big project, what you're suggesting, but which is your preferred alternative? Is it to put those homeowner responsibilities in statute, or, as you seem to allude to, make it a Department of Labor and Industry function? Do you have a preference, or are these just sort of ideas you're throwing out?
I think they're ideas that we've been developing, and I think that, truthfully, if it came through the Department of Labor and Industry or some other agency, it would help to clarify it with the warranty statute, state laws, and guidelines.
Other questions for the testifier? Is there anyone else in the audience? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Fulbert.
How do we accomplish that suggestion for... Do we direct the Department of Labor and Industries to do guidelines, or and maybe we don't like the guidelines that they do either?
And how do we do it without a fiscal note in this day and age?
Well, you can tell them to eat it, or do it 2 years from now.
There we go. Representative Simon.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Silver, that's a good question. I guess the devil's in the details, and I'm intrigued by the idea, and I, for one, would be willing to talk with Representative Lane and with you, Ms. Burnett, about how we might come up with a structure like that, if it's even workable. I don't know that it is, but it's an interesting idea. But I think Representative Silver goes to the heart of the matter.
Representative Lane, you've not been involved in this part of the conversation.
Yes, Ms. Burnett and I just had this discussion 10 minutes ago. So I would like to continue as we're going here with the idea that this is simply letting the homeowners understand what is in statute at this time. And if they have concerns that that's not the specific wording, what it implies in this particular bill, we're willing to change that and to have an ongoing discussion about how we could make it better as an actual so-called express warranty.
So if this committee moves your bill along to Commerce, you would be willing to work with Ms. Frenette on something that may emerge as an amendment at that point?
Right.
All right. Any other questions or comments in that case? Representative Lane, any final comments?
No, at this time, my understanding is that we're letting the people know what's in statute, but we'll attend to any details around that.
With that, Representative Simon renews his motion that House File 420 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lane. Representative Gardner. Welcome to the committee. The chair moves that House File 239. Yep. House File 239. Be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Gardner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Thanks for your time. This is a bill that was heard in this committee last session that relates to new home warranties and home improvement warranties and remedies for homeowners who are facing being out of their house or having a problem with their house being of lower value because of a breach. Mr. Chair, I'd like to perhaps ask your advice. I do have a delete all amendment which resolved an issue that took an hour in this committee to kind of wordsmith something so that we could move along more quickly.
There's half here already, Representative Gardner.
Okay, but there's part of it which I may have, I think I would like to tweak in Commerce and Labor Committee over some technical issues I was talking about with Mr. Andreessen. I thought it would be better to adopt and delete all of the good stuff and then maybe cut out the bad stuff at the next stop to demonstrate that I am listening to what it is the committee said last time on this issue. Does that make sense?
Okay, let's start with moving the chair will move the 239DE1 amendment. Representative Gardner, this puts the bill in the form that you wish at this time?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any discussion to the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Gardner, can you speak to the DE1, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This actually reinserts language on line 1.9 and 1.10 regarding what damages that someone can seek to claim to remedy the defect or breach under the warranty, and also the difference between the value of the dwelling without the defect and the value of the dwelling with the defect. The part that I was working hard between last year and this year was to figure out one other part. Because a lot of homeowners have not only had the breach to deal with, they sometimes have to be out of their house while the repairs are being done. And so you incur lodging costs, meals, and other incidental expenses. And so we spent about an hour in this committee last session just trying to come up with some limit to say, okay, what are the reasonable costs for being out of your house? And I believe one member said, well, when they were fixing my house, I just went to Florida, so should that be covered? And I think the intent was no. And so I'm taking a cue from something that the federal government does for when their employees or contractors travel to different parts of the United States, and they have to be away from home, and that's a per diem rate. This is different from the per diem that we have here in the legislature. So, for example, when I worked for a nonprofit in the Washington, D.C. area, and we'd bring international visitors to the United States and we'd have to put them up, the federal government has a per diem rate set by the General Services Administration. You can look that up on the web. It's updated regularly. It's different to reflect the cost of expenses in a particular area. If I was in Shoreview and I had to be out of my house because of warranty work, I could punch in my zip code to that site and it would tell me what the rate is. And there's two parts to it. One is maximum amount of lodging that could be covered, and then a maximum amount for meals and incidental expenses. And that gives you a maximum per diem rate. And that's what we have in the delete all amendment, is to say reasonable cost for short-term housing, meals, and incidental expenses made necessary as a result of the breach, not to exceed the current maximum per diem rate set by the USGSA that applies to the location of the property. And that last phrase is in there so that if I have to be out of my house in Shoreview, I'm not going to go to downtown Minneapolis, no offense, Mr. Chair, to the swankiest place in town, and that would count. So we're saying that there would be limits. You know, I'd go to the Hampton Inn or the right down the road, and that would be covered. Some parts of the state that are not listed on this handout that you have, this is just a sample page from Minnesota that the GSA has. I didn't handwrite in there that there's non-standard areas. So if you were in Park Rapids, for example, which is not on this list, there's a maximum level of $70 in lodging and $39 in meals and incidental expenses.
Would that apply to Bovee as well?
Bovee would be a non-standard area, a unique area, I might say, but a non-standard area.
Mr. Chair,
I don't know where the nice place is to stay in Bovee, but...
Well, we got a tent right on the bottom of the can of steel pit.
Okay.
Mostly for the commissioner, though. If he doesn't solve the can of steel pit, he's going to be washed away with it.
So Representative Gardner might be bunking with the commissioner.
Right, there you go.
Representative Solberg?
I do have one question, a serious question. And does this rate then apply to The homeowner itself, and what if I am a homeowner and I have a wife and seven kids? Do we all get a hundred and so? What's the intent, I think, is what I want to have on the record here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg and Mr. Andreessen was asking me the same question, and I had the same question, too. This is actually a per-person rate. It's kind of designed for adults who are traveling on business, but I could see a case where you might need a suite, for example, if you have seven kids, and you could, in theory, stack that up and say, okay, there's six people times, you know, $103 during the summer in Duluth, if that's where you are. But it was the best way that I could find to define what was reasonable. And what we came up with in this committee last time is, let's just stick in the word reasonable cost, and then we'll figure out something to figure out what that means. And so this is the best method that I could calculate.
Well, it is certainly an independent established rate, put some parameters on it that we did, were not able to find last year. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Solberg asked the question I was going to ask. I think I'm comforted by the reasonableness language. This is a ceiling, not a floor. The absolute maximum they could collect with this would be this, stacking or otherwise. And I think that when it comes to an award of damages, I'd be very, very surprised if a court would award, you know, multiple, you know, seven times stacking for going to the Hampton Inn.
Representative Gardner, we've adopted your DE1 amendment. Do you have a testifier?
Yes, I have Mr. Andreessen to explain why we need to do this in the first place.
All right. Mr. Andreessen, welcome back to the committee. Please, again, though, state your name and spell it for the record.
Chair Dabney Committee, I'm Scott Andreessen. Last name is A-N-D-R-E-S-E-N. And again, I would support this on behalf of homeowners, generally speaking, those who I've represented, and lawyers who represent homeowners. I will add a couple of things. Number one, as it goes forward, the difference between the original bill, House File 239, and the Delete Everything amendment, and what I think Representative Gardner is talking about in terms of tweaking it as it goes forward, is the purpose of the original bill, as I understand it, was to eliminate the restriction on a homeowner's ability to recover damages that would relate to a breach of statutory warranty. And there could be other damages that they might suffer that are not simply limited to short-term housing costs. And I'll give a, for example, this has happened to a number of my clients, one in particular right now, who had his house on the market, had bought a new house in Atlanta, was on his way down there. House up here is for sale. It's a very nice home. It's in 2006. The market's still good. A buyer comes in, says, I love your house, I want to buy it, but I want to do an inspection. They do an inspection, lo and behold, it's got the problem, the water intrusion mold problem. Well, now they can't sell that house without disclosing that problem. The builder doesn't want to fix their house because it's a very large house and it'll cost $500,000 or more. And so he ends up in litigation that takes 2.5 years and is now looking at thinking about trying to fix and sell his house. Well, the market for his house today is probably $300,000 less than it was when he had it sold in 2006. Now, should he be the one who bears the cost of that diminished value that is a result of nothing other than the breach of the statutory warranty by the builder in the first place? And the law, as it is currently drafted, would say that person, that homeowner, can only recover the money to fix their house, period. That's it. And that person also did have to move out of the house. So they couldn't recover their short-term expenses for moving out, and he couldn't recover for the loss he suffered as a result of the 3 years it's taken him to deal with this. And now we've got realtors who told him flat out, look, the house across the street sold for $1.1 million in 2006, and yesterday it sold for $560,000. So they took a $500,000 hit. Your house is across the street. You're not gonna get anywhere near what you would have gotten in 2006. And that's of no fault of that particular homeowner. The purpose of the original bill would just seem to allow for reasonable recovery, just as you would in a negligence cause of action or a breach of contract cause of action if you had it. This being the strongest protection that a homeowner has, I would say that it ought to afford the strongest right to recover.
Questions for the author of the testifier? Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the attorney testifier. So I think I got what you're saying there. So the market value of the house went down because the market went down, and it's almost the but-for. You know, but for the house being fixed, you could have sold it. Therefore, you're going to get the market value loss as well as the repair costs out of the construction company.
Potentially, if you could prove that you had those damages in court by having experts testify that yes, you could have sold it back in 2006 for price A, and now it's only worth price B, and it's going to cost you, you know, C to fix it. What I'm saying is that homeowner, if that is a direct result of the breach, should be able to recover those damages, and the laws that exist today would not allow that.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, following that line, then, Mr. Andreessen?
Correct.
If, Tim getting ready to sell my house, and I haven't checked the roof in a few years, same thing, inspection happens. The lack of due diligence, maybe as a homeowner on my part, for not checking the roof, I find out, geez, I need to repair the roof. Now it's going to take me 6 months. Again, as you said, it's Minnesota. They can't do my roof in November. They got to wait until March or this year, maybe May or June, to fix it. Under Representative Gardner's amendment here, would you know, in that case, again, if it was negligence by the home builder, but I hadn't found it as a homeowner, would I be able to go back in and therefore get the whatever I lost in the value of the home at that point too?
Mr. Andreessen,
if I understand your question, is your question assuming that the problem with your roof is a problem that is a defect in original construction?
Correct.
The answer is yes, except for the fact that this statute already has built into it an exclusion that says a homeowner may not recover under the warranty statute for their own failure to maintain their premises. So there was a case that went to trial just this last summer where, in fact, that happened. The jury came in and said, yeah, you've got some serious problems here, but 25% of the fault is on you, homeowner, because you didn't go and maintain your roof. In fact, it was a roof. And there was a specific exclusion right in the statute for that, and that exclusion would stay as it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we're heading down a slippery slope, and maybe Ms. Burnett will give us a little bit of example or background on this, but we're in 327A again, Mr. Chairman. I'll reiterate from the other day, we've been in 0.01, I believe, 0.02, 0.08, now 0.05. Again, all noteworthy and good ideas, but the fact that we're running 4, 5, maybe 6, 7, 8 bills when, as a group, if we could do this together, it would be great if we could lump them all into one. And I understand from testimony the other day there is something being put together from Representative Nelson's testimony. I'd like to see this by maybe some more attorneys let out a little bit further, because it feels a little bit scary to me that we're going to let a new hole into the statute that could mean a lot of additional lawsuits. And when our home builders are having a heck of a time now, I don't want to throw this kind of uncertainty into the market as well.
Thanks, Representative Zellers. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zellers, with the delete all amendment as it currently stands, the bill still keeps the stuff that's on 1.9 through 1.11 in place and only adds what reasonable cost is for short-term housing. So I think maybe you're expressing concerns about what might happen in commerce and labor after we amend it again, just to make sure that we know which version we're talking about.
Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 239 as amended? Ms. Burnett, welcome back.
And Mr. Chair, I'm really hoping Ms. Burnett says something nice about my bill and says how great it is now.
We can all just wait with bated breath. Ms. Burnett, please again state your name and spell it for the record, and we'll move on.
Sherman Dabney members. I'm Lisa Frenette, Effison Frank, R-E-N-E-T-T-E. I'm with the Builders Association of Minnesota. You may have to wait with bated breath a little while longer. Here's the nice part. While we appreciate the fact that Representative Gardner has continued to work with us and try to make this an easier piece of language, we still have concerns over it. And some of the concerns are, and I haven't seen or had time to look at the United States General Services Administration thing and really get to, it's the first time I've seen it, and get kind of an idea of how it works. But my concern is what decides when a person should have to move out? What if a homeowner has a couple of windows that need to be replaced? It won't take long, but it's not necessary to move out. They're in the basement. There was some water intrusion. What determines when they should move out, when it should be fixed, and when it's done? And so there's just still some questions that align around that give me pause to accept the amendment as a positive step in the right direction.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Frenette, I appreciate that concern. I would only point out that under current law, if you look at the DE amendment, mm-hmm. there are all sorts of these inquiries that, you know, we let courts decide. For example, and this is current law, 1.9, what is the amount necessary to remedy the defect or breach? Or line 1.10, what is the difference between the value of the dwelling with and without the defect? It's, pretty common. We leave these in statute, and the courts will sort it out. I mean, I think you're right to bring up the ambiguity, but it's no more ambiguous than the other things already in the statute, in my opinion.
Any other questions for Ms. Frenette? Thank you, ma'am. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 239 as amended? Seeing none, Representative Gardner, any last comments?
Mr. Chair, I'll just note that Ms. Frenette did say something nice just now about my...
for the record, she seems to be indicating no.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your thoughtful consideration of House File 239 as amended. I think it's better in better shape than it was a year ago. I think it has shown some reasonableness in terms of ambiguity as to what constitutes, what needs, what situation would need to arise as to when someone chooses to be out of the house. I guess we could have several pages on just under what conditions that could be. And I think as a non-attorney, non-builder, I would say no one, as a common sense rule, no one really wants to be out of their house. It's a real pain in the neck. I have two kids and a family, and so when we have to uproot ourselves for whatever reason, that it is a real inconvenience. And so people really want to stay in their homes as much as possible. I would just leave it there, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to your support. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. With that, Chair moves his motion that House File 239, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Gardner. Don't leave that chair. We're moving from inside the house to outside the house, Representative Gardner.
Does that mean to do with the warranties, Mr. Chairman?
It was yesterday on the floor, Representative Zellers, that we had the dormant Bush bill or something, So we were dealing, I think, with warranties and related issues there. The chair moves House File 403 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Gardner, you have an amendment to this bill as well, is that correct?
Yes, and I wholeheartedly hope that someone will move the GE2 amendment to fix some technical changes from the Environment Committee and also to more precisely focus on the labeling and retail issue that we'll be dealing with in this committee.
All right, so the chair moves House File 403 DE2 amendment to be before the committee. This is the author's amendment to put the bill in the order that he prefers. Any question to the DE2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Gardner, to your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I actually did have one oral amendment on my DE2 that just changes one date.
Is this
an appropriate time to do that?
Yes, it is.
On line 1.24, the last item on that page is 2012, and I would like to have that changed to 2013.
You can simply incorporate that in the amendment.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 403 as amended is bill.
One moment, please. We need to incorporate that.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
You can incorporate it.
If you already voted on the other one, please to make another motion.
Okay, look, we're going to back up and do it this way. The chair moves that on page 1, line 24, strike 2012, insert 2013 at the end of that line. Any discussion? Good to see no. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Now we're in good stead, Representative Gardner.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Solberg.
House File 403, as amended, is a bill that is designed to spur the growth of two industries in Minnesota. One is the compost industry, and the other one is the bioplastics industry in Minnesota. Having worked in the recycling and composting industries before I was elected, it turns out that a very substantial amount of the stuff that we throw away, that is our municipal solid waste, is compostable. And there are several things that we currently get rid of that are composted. One of them is yard waste, our leaves and grass clippings and woody brush. Some of that is actually used for biomass in the case of branches and trees and so on. That's actually how this building is heated through the district energy plant in downtown St. Paul. We also have seen cities like Wayzata, Duluth, and Hutchinson, as well as Edina, is now going to start collecting food waste and other non-recyclable paper, which is compostable, at the curb. Former Representative Burns actually was my best cheerleader for this type of bill because he was on the city council in Wayzata when they started collecting food waste and non-recyclable paper because he actually saved money on his garbage bill by doing that. But it's not here, unfortunately. Section 1 was actually dealt with in the Environment Committee, and Section 2 is the reason why this bill is in this committee. So I won't beat you over the head with what's in Section 1 except to explain the changes.
Representative Gardner, just for your and the committee's and the public's knowledge, we then will only be dealing with Section 2, the part that is under the jurisdiction of this committee.
Well, Mr. Chair, that would be great. So can I'll skip the back side of the page.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the major problem, Mr. Chair. The compostable bag industry, which has as its nexus, I know Representative Zeller is shaking his head, he wouldn't be surprised, they're actually major manufacturers of bioplastics here in Minnesota. One of them is a joint venture of Cargill, which makes a polylactic acid-based plastic film. They also make compostable serviceware like knives, cups, forks, and the like. But that's not the focus of this bill. It's for the film. We also have several manufacturers here in Minnesota, in Cambridge, White Bear Lake, and Circle Pines, that actually make compostable film. And they started out by working in corrosion inhibitor products. I don't quite know how they made the leap to compostables, but in any case, this material is also bio-based, and it's designed to completely break down in a compost site. Now, you might ask, why is that important? And the issue is compost actually conserves carbon. The Climate Change Advisory Group that came out with its report last year shows that we can actually get a fairly big bang for our buck by composting more waste that otherwise would be in a landfill where it would create methane, and methane is 20 times more effective at absorbing heat than carbon dioxide. So it's actually in our interest, at least in meeting our carbon dioxide targets, to compost more. Here's the problem, though. One of the things that we compost a lot of, which is yard waste, is often put in plastic bags, and it goes to compost sites, and the plastic bag never degrades. And so the compost site operators, who are often in the private sector, have something that is of fairly low value that they can't do anything with. And the customers who would easily buy and do want to buy high-valued, high-quality compost, and I have a sample. They can sell it at a premium, but not if it has the plastic in it. I will say that what I'm proposing is not exactly new. If you represent part of Dakota County, you already have what's in Section 1 in ordinance. You are required to use a compostable bag, whether it's paper or plastic, or use a cart. So it's nothing new. The bill would actually require the same thing in all 7 metro counties, except in Minneapolis, the city with the first class with organized collection, which will wait until 2013 because of some technical issues, Mr. Chair, but I won't beat you over the head of that. So our effort here is to try and create a level playing field across the metro Right now, my hauler requires me to use a cart or a compostable bag, not plastic, and they will charge me more if I use a plastic bag. But they are undercut by competitors who will accept plastic. Some yard waste sites have specifically prohibited all bags because they're ending up with the plastic. So we're trying to create a level playing field in the intra-commerce or sector here for compost to add more value to this and to create more jobs. I have an example of some compostable bags. You know, the pages always tell me that they like my compost bills because there's lots of cool stuff to show.
Show and tell, Representative Gardner.
Very good. Well, enough about how the mechanics would work, but we have a problem. The compostable bag industry tells us that there are lax standards as it relates to what is biodegradable. Many of you may have seen labels like the Star Tribune sleeve that say this bag is oxo-degradable or oxo-biodegradable. There's no technical standard whatsoever to explain what that means. And in fact, I'll have a testifier here who will show you what happens to this. A compostable bag, though, has to meet an ASTM standard. Believe it or not, there is an ASTM standard D6400, which pretty much says you have to prove that something is completely compostable so it turns into dirt. So we're asking this committee to make it state law that if you use the word compostable, it must be certified as meeting the ASTM 6400 standard, and that you cannot market a bag and label it as degradable, biodegradable, or any other form thereof, because until there is a technical standard that specifies that's what it is.
Representative Gardner, is this related to the issue that I understand that compostable materials go to landfills, but then the landfills are covered up, and so the necessary process doesn't occur?
Mr. Chair, that's a question I get a lot. This bill has nothing to do with bags that go to landfills, because once a bag gets into a landfill, its resource conservation value is really lost. And I've had people say, oh, this is going to solve the problem of plastic bags not degrading in landfills. And my answer is no, this has nothing to do with landfills. It has to do with a compost site, which is an above-ground site where the material is turned and little microbes do their thing. And even during the middle of the winter, there's a big pile of dirt that's cooking at 120 degrees Fahrenheit to make compost. So it doesn't have anything to do with stuff going into landfill. It wouldn't prohibit anybody from using plastic bags for the garbage, for example. But anything going to a yard waste site or a compost site, there's two different categories, would have to have compostable plastics if they use plastic.
All right.
If you have a cart, carts are fine. If you use a paper bag, that's fine.
Do you have a testifier?
I do. I have a gentleman from Cortec Plastic who can tell you a little bit about the compostable film industry's perspective on this.
So please come to the table. Introduce yourself, including the spelling of your name. If you can limit your testimony to no more than 5 minutes, that would be appreciated.
Well,
welcome to the committee.
And Mr. Chair, I just want to point out that the Biodegradable Plastics Institute does have a press release from the National Advertising Division of the Council of Better Business Bureaus, which is asking the people who make the degradable bags to essentially cease and desist from claims about degradability without meeting an ASTM standard.
Thank you. Sir, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, committee, thank you. My name is Cliff Krakauer, last name spelled C-R-A-C-A-U-E-R. And I want to address what Representative Gardner has talked about as far as marketing claims. As a company, we got into developing biodegradable plastics for a separate part of our business in the late 1990s and diverged into the compostable field. What we're finding in the U.S., Minnesota specifically, is that because of the confusion in the language, consumers honestly can't determine the difference between compostable, degradable, biodegradable. And while the compostable industry, the composting industry, has a standard that is accepted worldwide, which is ASTM D6400, the manufacturers that are producing oxo-degradable films, which is actually a non-biodegradable plastic with a magic additive in it, make the claim that it's degradable, and it's very difficult for consumers, retailers, to differentiate that. What we'd like to see is that any manufacturers be required to to pass the D6400 standard, which is already set and proven with science to work, in order to make a claim of biodegradable, degradable, or compostable. We did a lot of studies on whether or not these other technologies actually work, and tried to make them meet the D6400 standard, and they simply don't. What's important with compost is that if you fragment plastics inside of it, it actually deteriorates the compost and can be a source of contamination. E. coli can grow in it. So really the material needs to break down 100% in a 180-day time period. The technologies that are confusing the marketplace, I don't know if we can pass this around, simply don't break down in that time period. An example of where this has become successful is in Eastern Canada, where they actually require D6400 to be used. They've reduced landfill by more than 50%, and households actually have retail outlets that have properly marked and properly identified compostable bags available for consumers. In Minnesota, it's difficult to get retailers, Target being an example, to want to market this type of product because there's too much confusion. And they have the concern that they don't have an infrastructure to sell the product, so consumers aren't going to want to use it. What's the confusion?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Krakauer. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for you, going back to subdivision 1 of Section 2. Line 2.2 states that a person may not offer for sale in this state, and then you know, this is effective following the final day of the night. Does that mean that any bag that is labeled biodegradable, degradable, or any of those forms must be basically immediately pulled off the shelves?
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, I had that thought last night as I was home, there are actually several manufacturers of compostable bags who also use the word biodegradable currently, because they're trying to compete with the inferior bags. And now that you mention it, I think it might be appropriate when I go to Commerce and Labor to change the date of enactment so that we can make sure there's a phase out of the stuff that's on the shelves.
Well, Representative Gardner, why don't we do that right here?
Well, gosh, Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski has said the committees is where they do the work. So if Representative Sanders had a suggestion, my neighbor and colleague in Blaine.
Or perhaps I could drag Mr. Pender into this. Or Ms. Newman for a suggestion. Pardon?
20
you know, it is. It is. That's true, Representative Ellis. Thank you for your contribution to the committee's work today.
I would note, Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish suggested 99 years, I think. It didn't take very well.
Mr. Pender, what would be an appropriate effective date?
Mr. Chair and members, would depend on what Representative Gardner wants, I guess, in terms of an effective date.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a thought. Since the phase-in of the prohibition on use of the non-compostable stuff is January 1, 2010, how about we make the effective date on the standards January 1, 2010, or December 31st, 2009? And we could watch the clock tick on New Year's Eve and make sure the shelves are clear. Does that make sense?
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, could you repeat that?
Certainly.
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Pender, line 2.24, could we make, Section 1 would be effective, but there are dates in there, but if we could say in Section 2, it's effective January 1, 2010.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair, so to amend the effective date there on line 2.24, we would strike the words and to are and insert is, and then after that sentence we would say section 2 is effective January 1. I'm going to go back here. Line 2.24, we'd also need to delete sections and insert section, singular.
So delete the S on sections, yes. On 2.24.
Yes. And then we'd have a sentence after the existing sentence. That says section 2 is effective January 1, 2010.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sanders, thank
you. A question that may relate to how we decide what were the dates that we were deciding on.
You have the floor, Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed in line 2.5 we start the basically the how the bags need to be labeled and what type of stringent, classification or standards that they need to meet. How many, bags or companies are currently making these? Are they available now? How long is this process actually taking? Do we need to kind of consider that as getting them stocked onto the shelves that consumers, adequately purchase them at the same time that the other bags are disappearing.
Representative Gardner.
And Representative Sanders, during my deliberations about drafting the bill, I did speak extensively to the compostable bag manufacturers, and many of these are actually in retailer stores now, but in smaller volumes, and they assured me that they can ramp up in time. The original bill actually said September 1, 2009, and they said they could meet that, but the compost site operator said we can't educate people that fast in the middle of the yard waste season, so let's go to January 1, 2010. That was a key concern of mine also, Representative Sanders.
Mr. Bender.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gardner, I have a couple of thoughts about the effective dates on Section 1. First of all, in line 1.13, the way that's worded after January 1, 2010 means it would be effective January 2nd, which is kind of unusual. So I guess I'd suggest adding before, after, on or after.
So page 1, line 13, add on or before the word after the C.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And then that... That paragraph C then seems to be effective then January 1, 2010, but we have then the effective date at the end of the bill that we just amended still reads Section 1 is effective the day following final enactment, which I guess would make that sentence then apply to things that are in Section 1, D, and E, but not in C. So I wonder if, but it seems to me those the C, D, and E seems to me should all go together. So I wonder if you don't want to just change on the back on line 2.24, change it to read Section 1 is effective January 1, or on or at, or is effective January 1, 2010.
Mr. Chair, sounds good to me.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair, then maybe we could just simplify it.
Please.
by on line 2.24, going back to the way it originally is in the bill and striking or deleting the day following final enactment and inserting January 1, 2010. That way both sections 1 and 2 would be effective January 1, 2010.
So, Mr. Pender, if I'm clear as to what the chair's motion is going to be in a moment, it's two parts. It adds on page 1, line 13, after the C, the words on or, and then on page 2, line 24, that line would now read sections 1 and 2 are effective January 1, 2010. Is that correct, Mr. Pender?
That's correct.
Mr. Gardner, is that to your liking?
Mr. Chair, it'll be a happy New Year. That sounds fine to me.
Any question or comments to the amendment? Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. if I'm getting this right, the now this is going to take, the bill is going to take effect January 1, 2010. Is that what we're doing here?
That would be my understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question I had, and as we're going through this, and have we talked to retailers, have we talked to suppliers, are they going to be able to comply with this? I think I heard Representative Gardner say this. This is going to Commerce after here?
That's correct. That's the motion, Representative Nelson.
Okay, because I would hope he would get input, Representative Gardner would get input from those people, that so we know we're not setting something up that can't happen, so that we're doing it. That's a concern I have, because maybe we want to wait to do this amendment until he finds out maybe this may not be the appropriate date, and so he wouldn't have to amend it again if there is an issue that would be a problem with, and if we could do this amendment in Commerce, I guess.
Representative Gardner, can you respond, please?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd be fine with Mr. Pender's suggestion that we just make everything January 1, 2010, or on or after 2010, just for consistency. But the retailers have all told me that they're waiting for consistent signals from the market and government as to what stuff they should not be carrying and what stuff they should be carrying. But I'd be happy to talk to Mr. Anderson at the Retailers Association and just double-check. But I'd like to stick with what Mr. Pender is suggesting to on the enactment date, because that would actually make it consistent for both sections at this time.
All right. Any other questions or comments to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in... Oh, okay. The chair will move that page 1, line 13, after the C, add the words on or... And page 2, line 24, sections 1 and 2 are effective January 1, 2010. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Zellers, is that a request for?
Yeah, just had a question, Mr. Chairman, before we go any further. Representative Gardner, have you... The issue seems to be a commerce-related issue. Have you spoken to the Commerce Department about, before we put a bunch of obviously confusing stuff into law here again, I know this isn't your last stop, but have you talked to the Commerce Department about this? Are there rules in place right now that they can use for enforcement? It seems like this is right up their alley, and if some of our municipalities are already doing this, I would assume that they can work together. Not only, we've got tons of different local municipals, come to tax committee, they're there quite often, but I'm just curious if we've gone to the Commerce Department and then some of those local governments first before adding a whole bunch of new stuff into law.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zellers, as it relates to local government, in your packet, the last item there is the legislative platform for the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, which is 6 of the 7 metro counties, and right at the bottom they have supported essentially what's in the bill. I have not talked to the Commerce Department. I've known them from the Energy Committee, but compared to some of the other bills I've carried this year, usually there's this gauntlet of people waiting at the door for me to say, Representative Gardner, I have a problem with your bill. I have not had that contact from the Commerce Department on this issue, but I would be happy to check before we go to Commerce.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the kind of the fits and changes we made here. Commerce Department already has a lot of authority in statute the way it is under rulemaking. I would assume and I would see something like this when it comes to labeling being right up their alley, and rather than adding a whole bunch of new law and $100 to $5,000 penalty for violation to our job providers right now, that's awfully scary stuff. That's poison for job providers. So before we get to the next committee, maybe that would be a great idea to talk to Commerce. I'll be more than happy to direct you to the right person in the Commerce Department, because this to me seems awfully heavy-handed, and especially the penalty section. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, I will certainly take that under advisement, but in terms of Commerce, I would point out they've got many businesses located here in Minnesota who have support letters for this bill who are talking about the level competitive playing field, and they feel like they're having an anti-competitive situation right now because of the misleading labeling claims. I certainly will take your comments about the penalty under advisement and talk to Commerce.
Any other comments or questions? Representative Mack.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Gardner, I'm just a little confused, and I'm wondering if you could answer the reasoning on line 2.2 and again on 2.16. You have a person may not offer for sale, and then again on 2.16, a person who violates subdivision 1. I'm wondering how those two interact, if there's a lot of individuals out there on their own selling these plastic bags, or if this is more to retailers and companies. And then in line 2.16 and 2.17, if those violations are to the companies that have these bags on their shelves, and all that relates back to the use of the word a person.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mack. I think Mr. Pender can explain the arcane description of why statutes use a person.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mack, in Chapter 645 of Minnesota statutes, that chapter is almost entirely definitions, and it basically says that the terms defined here, if they're used in statute, this is what they mean. And the word person is defined in that chapter, and it basically means really anybody or anything. So it includes an individual, a corporation, a partnership, a limited liability company, a governmental unit. It's defined broadly enough to encompass anything, and so that lets us use that word anytime we want to without putting in a laundry list of all the different kinds of people whose activities we're trying to influence.
President Mack? Okay. Thank you very much. Anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 403 as amended? Seeing none, Representative Gardner, any closing comments for the committee?
None. Appreciate your support. I know this topic sounds a little weird, but I've been in the legislature for 2 years now, and I've heard a lot weirder stuff than this. Everything from fish diseases to letting people use two lines instead of one. So I hope I have opened your eyes to a new weird category, and I look forward to your support.
All right, careful, Representative Gardner. Representative Solberg is coming up with a fish amendment for your bill. With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 403 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Representative Johnson, you've got just a short bill here in front of our committee. Well, it is, Representative Zellers. I don't know why you're laughing.
It's only one page.
The hope, wish, and intent of the chair is that we will conclude this committee on time with a vote on House File 813. To arrive at that, I would ask both sides on this bill to please try to limit their testimony to no more than 10 minutes. That allows roughly 10 minutes for the committee's questions, debate, and discussion, and then move to a vote. Representative Johnson, welcome to the committee. The chair will move that House File 813 be recommended to pass, and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm just going to say a few words about the bill and why it's needed, also what the bill does, and then I'm going to turn it over to a couple testifiers I have with me here from Joint Council 32, Ed Renoso and Don Gertesmeyer. So with that, let me just begin about talking a little bit about why the bill is needed. And it's a bill about misclassifying employees as independent contractors, which in Minnesota is a huge problem. We saw a report back in November of 2007 from the legislative auditor who made the same conclusion, finding that 14% of our workforce was in fact being misclassified. And just briefly, the misclassifying is a huge issue for a couple of reasons. Let me just name a couple of them. One, it deprives workers from the many protections and benefits they deserve, such as workers' comp, unemployment benefits, and so forth. Secondly, particularly given the economic crisis we have here in the state of Minnesota with our budget, it wrongfully deprives the state of millions of dollars in revenue, whether it's workers' comp contributions, unemployment taxes, Social Security taxes. And thirdly, and maybe even most importantly, it punishes those employers who play by the rules. Other employers, unfortunately, try to reduce the cost of doing business by misclassifying employees as independent contractors, and that results in a competitive disadvantage, clearly. What this bill does is focus on misclassification of the trucking industry or courier industry, Reports from Deed and others in the industry indicate it's a huge problem, especially in this area. Let me just say a few words about that. We've received reports from courier companies, in particular, to hire drivers and call them independent contractors, even though the driver does not work for any other company. The driver wears the company's uniform, receives training for the company. The driver is assigned a route by the company, is told when to show up for work and when he can go home at night. And they call these folks independent contractors. Now, Deed regularly audits all of sorts of Minnesota employers to determine whether they're misclassifying their workers. And going back 3 years, Deed has audited 30 of the 67 local trucking or courier companies in Minnesota. And here's what it's found out, folks. It's found out 11 of these 30 companies, 35% misclassify employees as independent contractors. That includes the 5 audits that Deed has recently done but hasn't completed the appeals process. What this bill does now is address this problem in several ways. And you can follow along on the bill on starting at 2.1 through 2.9. First thing it does is it looks at whether the driver is substantially free from control by the employer, first off. Secondly, the service provided by the driver is either outside the employer's usual course of business or is performed outside the employer's place of business. And the third factor that's looked at is where the driver is customarily engaged in independent trade, and when he's not employed, that doesn't end the employment for that particular person. The second thing the bill does is request sufficient audits be done of the trucking industry to determine the extent of misclassification. We know it's a problem. We found that out, and this bill seeks the audit provision. It also talks about increasing and sharing data regarding misclassification. And lastly, it permits workers, the last point, to request confidentially an employee status determination. That, in summary, Mr. Chair and members, is the bill. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Gertesmeyer. I just want to make a couple of comments, and then Mr. Reynoso.
Mr. Gertesmeyer, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, spell it, and then proceed with your testimony, sir.
Chairman Dabney, members of the committee, my name is Don Gertesmeyer, last name G-E-R-D-E-S-M-E-I-E-R. I'm political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32. We represent over 60,000 members in Minnesota, Iowa, North and South Dakota. I understand that over the last couple of days, members of the committee have received rather large volume, either some of all of you, calls in opposition to House File 813. The 12 House districts that are represented in this committee, Teamsters Joint Council 32, has 6,155 members. We could have activated them and had you deluge you with calls in support of 813. We decided not to do that. We know that there was phone problems with the calls that you were receiving in opposition. You have other constituents that you need to hear from. So do not take our silence on that issue as non-support from our 6,000 members in your district. We are asking you to take a hard look at 813 and hope that you will find it favorably, and Ed Reynoso is going to present the bill, and I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Gertesmeyer. Mr. Reynoso, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, spell it, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Edward Reynoso, R-E-Y-N-O-S-O, and I represent Teamsters Joint Council 32. Teamsters Joint Council 32 has in excess of 62,000 active and retired members in the state that Don Gertesmeyer just had mentioned. I come here to testify in support of House File 813. I would like to start off by stating that we want to be absolutely clear regarding our position on independent contractors. We feel that working as an independent contractor is a legitimate alternative to being an employee, and using independent contractors is a legal means of doing business. However, in Minnesota and nationally, there has been a growing concern about the number of workers who are in fact employees but are being treated as independent contractors. This overall campaign is targeting approximately 1.5 million workers nationally that are being misclassified by their employers for various reasons, many of those in Minnesota and specifically in the trucking industry. We recognize that there are over 13.5 legitimate independent contractors. That is more than 7% of the nation's total workforce that we have absolutely no desire to put out of business. We are in no way trying to eliminate a company from using independent contractors if they are properly classified. Our goal is to eliminate the ambiguous and cloudy current test that really isn't a test at all, but a set of vague and flexible guidelines that are confusing even to the good and honest employers. We feel that our state legislature should do all it can to clarify the language to prevent employers from misclassifying workers either accidentally or by design. The Legislative Audit Report of November 2007 cited various problems with our current system in determining independent contractor status. There was definitely some information that was enlightening to all of us, and some that really shined a light on a growing problem in just about every field that you can imagine. There was also additional alarming information because we found out that many of the audits only take place if an independent contractor files for benefits. The reality is that if a worker is under the impression that he or she is an independent contractor, it would be very unlikely to apply for benefits. Now, when a worker is correctly classified, employers incur direct costs for their share of federal Social Security and Medicare taxes, unemployment insurance taxes, workers' compensation insurance premiums, and minimum wage and overtime. Rising medical costs and workers' compensation premiums are particularly costly in an injury-prone industry such as trucking. Because of these costs, many employers find the risk of penalties associated with misclassifying employees to be outweighed by the competitive advantage that arises from doing so. This is clearly an unfair competitive advantage and should be stopped. Companies that operate by the rules and classify their employees correctly, in essence, are penalized for doing the right thing, which is fundamentally wrong. Exhibit A, you have a copy of the Legislative Audit Report, one page that comes out of it, goes over the cost factors that the Legislative Audit Report cited as the difference in cost of an employee versus an independent contractor. We feel that this is a good comparison because this is close to what many of our members in the parcel industry are currently making. Now, if you take that $7.82 an hour and put some real numbers to it, the savings of $7.82 for a regular 40-hour work week, and then you multiply it by 52 weeks, you come up to a total of $16,265.60. Now, for an employer that has over 100, or say, hypothetically, 100 employees, classified as independent contractors, $1.6 million plus. That's why we feel in many cases misclassification is likely deliberate and by design, as the Legislative Audit Report also stated. Misclassification not only affects competition, but it also affects governments and taxpayers, in large part because of the lost tax revenue. For example, both the state and federal governments use unemployment tax revenue when the employers misclassify the workers as independent contractors. It also is estimated that the state our size, the loss is approximately $150 million a year for misclassifying workers. Now, let me repeat this. This is $150 million that the state loses in taxable income. Understanding the budget crisis that our state is experiencing, it would seem to me that our state government should feel compelled to act in an expeditious manner and pass legislation to address this lost revenue. There's also a huge burden on the Minnesota taxpayer in the fact that many owner-operators have no health care, workers' compensation, or unemployment benefits. If they were to injure themselves while working, who'll pay for it? Unfortunately, many times, it will be the taxpayer that will fit the bill at the emergency room or by state assistance to the unemployed and injured. Another misconception about this bill is that it will have a negative effect on jobs. Many of these companies are telling their employees, or independent contractors, or whatever we want to call them, that we are after their jobs. That is not true. We want this company to correctly classify them, pay them their fair due, and treat them with respect that all workers are entitled to. If a particular company has to reclassify their drivers as employees, they're probably never independent contractors to start off with. They were just workers that were being shortchanged on pay, benefits, and workers' rights. So to the proposed legislation, we are supportive of it for many reasons, but let me just mention a few. Section 1 clears up the confusion by making it clear and concrete what it takes to be a true independent contractor in the state of Minnesota. This ABC test is used in 23 other states, specifically 17 states in the trucking industry. This language has been tried and tested and proved to be bulletproof when it comes to legal challenges. You may have some opponents say that they cannot comply to these standards. But let me be clear. Many of these opponents currently operate in other states that use this identical ABC test. Section 2 mandates data sharing. Audits of known violators and good work as an avenue to get determination from any of the three departments without fear of losing their job. Here's the Joint Council 32 and all of its dedicated members would appreciate your support and vote for House File 813. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of this committee. This concludes my testimony. I can stand for questions or any comments.
Thank you, Mr. Renoso. Representative Sanders, I believe you had a question. No?
No.
All right. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for any of the testifiers who care to answer this. You know, we did get a lot of calls, no question about it, and we've got to take that seriously, obviously. And I know that it was an uneven playing field for the reason that Mr. Kirschmeyer mentioned. But one of the arguments that I know several of the callers made to me, and I was just wondering if you would address it, is the seasonal argument. They said that, look, you know, you've got some folks who want to be truckers just for a few months out of the year, the winter months probably, because they're involved, for example, in agriculture, and they want to continue to be able to do that. Could you address that issue? And, you know, to the extent you think that's a valid concern, or maybe you don't.
Mr. Renoso, again, request that the questions from committee members and answers be brief. The alternative is that we would recess and return at 4:30 to complete the deliberations and vote.
Mr. Renoso. Chairman, Representative Simon, I believe the determining factors would still be controlled or determined by any one of the three departments. I wouldn't know exactly how to say whether that would be an independent contractor or not. I believe there would be certain parameters and certain questions and criteria that any one of the three departments would have to figure out. I'd hate to say whether or not that person would be an independent contractor.
Representative Simon.
One other brief one in the interest of time. I don't think it's a big secret that one of the companies, I would imagine, probably 80% of the calls that I got were from the DART Corporation. Is that a company that operates in any of these other states that have this exact language in place?
Mr. Renoso.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, from my understanding, DART operates in 48 states.
Representative Johnson, any other testifiers for House File 813?
No, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify against House File 813? Good morning, or almost afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Ask again that testimony be limited as best you can to no more than 5 minutes. Please state your name for the record. I'll let you guys decide who goes first, spell it, and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Hauslad, and I'm president of the Minnesota Trucking Association. That's H-A-U-S-L-A-D-E-N, Hauslad. And we represent 700 member firms that have both employees and independent contractors. We are tag-teaming today. There are three of us, and I want to stress I have two independent contractors here today who have chosen to come off the road. They are not earning revenue because they want to be here today, and we want to make sure that they get their testimony heard as well. They're going to talk about their aspects. I want to cover just a few technical points and then turn it over. And I just want to say flat out, we disagree strongly with the assumptions of the testifiers previously. We oppose House File 813. We do not agree that there's a huge misclassification problem, and we strongly think that their bill will not resolve a problem that's not there. First, let's talk about the report. There is no evidence of significant misclassification within the trucking industry. If you look at the report that the previous testifier cited, they're citing a misclassification for all industries. But if you look at trucking specifically, that report cites trucking at only 3%. And in fact, it is the lowest of all of those shown on the chart compared to other industries. And in fact, a strong argument can be made that the data demonstrates that when you do have a clear, specific definition, as we do have now, it prohibits or reduces misclassification. And we think that it actually reduces the errors. Secondly, we believe House File 813 actually flies directly in the face of the recommendations of that report. The report calls, and I'm quoting now, for greater standardization of the criteria used to determine the status of workers. But instead of bringing uniformity, House File 813 adds yet another definition to an already confusing mix of definitions used to determine independent contractor status in the trucking industry. So I believe you have a one-page handout, two-sided, that the staff just gave you. Is that out there? Okay, thank you. Side A is what currently determines if someone's an independent contractor. Under labor and industry, workers' compensation has a seven-factor rule. Under unemployment, there's a statute that it has six factors, and then revenue uses a 20-factor IRS test. And I will note that the workers' comp rule and the UC statute are almost identical with the exception of that missing block. Where it gets confusing, of course, is when you go to revenue, and that's the second handout, which has the 20 factors. Now, if you turn to the second side of that, side B, just turn it over, if you adopt House File 813, you are now adding, you're removing the existing UC statute, and you're adding the ABC test, and now you have three different definitions for determining who is an independent contractor. We think that rather than helping the situation, this ABC test actually makes it more confusing. And third, let's be clear that the ABC test is a test designed to be applied to all industries. By its nature, it is very broad, and because of that, as a consequence, it actually adds confusion, not clarity, especially with regard to trucking. Let's be clear about the two gentlemen with me today. Who are they? They're ICs. They're highly skilled professionals. They have large investments of over $100,000 in their vehicles to purchase their truck. They run year-round. They decide when to take a load, what route to take, where to buy the fuel. And with that as the background, let's just talk about the three factors quickly, and then I'll pass it off to them. Just see if ABC makes sense to you. Look at the definitions in the bill. Factor A says that an individual must be substantially free from control. So let's talk about control. Under federal law, a motor carrier must, and I underscore must, make certain that the independent contractor satisfies various federal regulations. There's no choice in the matter. You have to make sure that that IC is doing drug testing, has a current commercial driver's license, maintains logs, maintains the equipment to certain standards, and you can go to a whole other section of federal regulation, the leasing regulations, which say, quote, that the motor carrier has to have exclusive possession, control, and use of the equipment for the duration of the contract. My question is, who's exerting the control here? It's the federal government. It's not the motor carrier. That's the A factor. B factor says the service must be performed outside the usual course of business or outside of all places. Let's think about the places where this business takes place. Imagine, if you will, members, let's pretend you're an independent contractor today, and you're in your truck. You're in that power unit, that tractor. You're paying for it. You've paid for it. You're running. And you're going to go and pick up a trailer for Acme Transport. Acme owns the trailer. The trailer's full of products for 3M. You pull into a 3M distribution center, hook up to the motor carrier's trailer, and pull it out. Are you an IC or an independent contractor under this definition? It is confusing. And the third factor, Factor C, it says that the individual is customarily engaged in an independently established trade and does not become unemployed when the relationship ends. Again, you're an independent contractor. The carrier you haul for has a contract with Best Buy. Because of the recession, Best Buy says we're not going to haul as many electronics. We're going to have the Acme Transport carry less. Acme says to the IC, sorry, we don't need you now. We're going to discontinue our contract. Again, are you an IC? Or you're an employee. These definitions do not bring clarity. They bring confusion. What exists works. And I would cite the data that they cited about the number of audits for couriers. We've not seen that published. But I would say if the audits are finding misclassification, it would tell us the current definitions are actually working and don't need to be changed that dramatically. We ask you to reject House File 813. We have a bill we will be introducing that we think brings the consistency that the legislative auditor asked for, And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Bob Toey.
Actually, Mr. Alfadden, there are two members who have questions. Representative Sanders?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is, I actually kind of had this area highlighted that you just spoke to, and I don't know if Representative Johnson needs to answer this or who can, but I'll take points of view from all sides. Line 2.4 into 2.5 says, service is performed outside of all the places of business of the enterprise for which the service is performed. And my question is there, is the intent that this would prohibit a contractor from loading or unloading the product at the premises of a building? So if he was to participate in the loading or unloading of the product, would that then classify him as an employee?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hausbaden.
Therein lies the problem. You're leaving it up to an agency or some other determinator to look at that situation and say, well, you picked up at that lot, so you're now an employee. It's not clear. That's the exposure we have.
Further questions, Representative Sanders?
Mr. Chair, if you'd allow, I would like Representative Johnson's maybe intent or your thoughts on that part of the bill.
Representative Johnson, do you need the question repeated?
I certainly am.
So with respect to...
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the line 2.4 and 2.5, where it says service is performed outside of all the places of business of the enterprise. And my question is, would that, if a independent contractor was to participate in the loading or unloading of a product on the premises of a building, would that then classify him as an employee for participating in the loading or unloading?
Well, Mr. Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suspect what an auditor would look at in that particular case would be, you know, if a worker was at an employer's warehouse sorting packages all day, he would not fit the classification of independent contractor. So that's the kind of example I would cite.
So as another example, just because I really want to kind of understand the intent, is let's say they're not sorting packages all day, but they're actually helping physically unload the packages from the trailer, the product. Would just the fact that they are helping to load or unload the product classify them at the premises, because that's what it says here, services performed outside of all places of business of the enterprise, would that classify them as an employee, or would they still be an independent contractor?
Representative Johnson.
Now, Mr. Chair, again, the auditor is going to look at all three factors. The main issue in this is one of control and who's controlling the situation. If the employee is under the control of the employer over the context of the situation, clearly he's not an independent contractor.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question I have goes to, again, the issue of control. You, in your testimony, talked about, I pick up a truck, I bring my truck, my trailer, or my tractor there, and I hook it up to a truck or a trailer, and I drive it away, and it has Best Buy products in it. Would you consider that person an independent contractor if they could only deliver for Best Buy? If you're saying that you, in your course of contracting with them, that you can only deliver for Best Buy, you can't deliver for Circuit City or Target or anybody else, would you consider them an employee, or would they still be an independent contractor? I mean, that's, I guess, where the control is. That's my question.
Mr. Hausbaden. Mr. Chairman, Representative, again, it's not a function of, I'm using that as one example of a type of carrier. You could have a dedicated run, though, whereas you have the independent contractor say, sure, I'll sign on because I want to haul just for Target in town. You can make that choice. That doesn't make you an employee because you've chosen to say, yeah, I'll accept that run, but maybe next week, I don't want to drive for you anymore. I want to drive for someone else. There's not control that limits them from being able to drive for another motor carrier.
Representative Nelson.
I guess that gets at what I'm saying. But if you say that you can only drive, if you're driving for Best Buy or for Target, you can only drive for Target, I won't let you go pick up for Walmart. I won't let you pick up for Kmart or Best Buy or anybody else. Are they an employee, or are they, in that situation, or would they be an independent contractor? If you're saying you have to exclusively haul for me.
Mr. Huffman.
Again, I will point out that federal leasing law does say that while you are contracted to a motor carrier, the motor carrier does have exclusive, and I'll read the phrase here again, that the motor carrier must have exclusive possession, control, and use of the equipment for the duration of the contract. That's a federal requirement. So again, if the independent contractor has said, I'm willing to exclusively haul for Target, I make that choice, they're an independent contractor. So there may be other situations where other business models are set up where they would say an employee is a better use for that particular haul, but in our example, I guess the point we're trying to make is you can see this definition is not making it clear. And again, for the proponents to say that somehow we're taking a standard and now making it rock hard, bulletproof, clear, we disagree.
Mr. Reynoso? We seem to be focused on this issue of the interaction between the definition in House File 813 and some federal rules or regulations, as Mr. Housewadden is describing them. Can you speak, you testified earlier that this definition is used in other states. Are those other states able to deal with this relationship between federal rules and regulations and this definition of independent contractor?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Please say your name again for the record, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, from our understanding, the 17 states that currently use the ABC test, specifically in the trucking industry, have had zero problems, if any, that we've heard of. I asked various sources whether there are problems. Now, you have to really consider what is really a problem. If it's somebody that can't qualify under independent contractor status, the three-point criteria, because now the criteria is much more defined and clear, I don't know if that's much more a problem than a fix. So as far as problems and legal challenges, from our understanding, this ABC language has been tested and is shown to be bulletproof.
Mr. Housewadden.
And Mr. Chair, we want to hear today that we could provide instances where the exact opposite is the case, where it has not been bulletproof. Legitimate independent contractors have had a tough time meeting that definition, and there is confusion between states. So if you want that, we can have our legal counsel provide that for you. It is not a slam dunk.
Mr. Tully, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, spell it, and proceed with your testimony. Before you do, however, it is 12 o'clock. That is the adjournment time for this committee. I will look to going until 12:15 and taking a vote at that time to allow particularly these two gentlemen who came in today and took time off of their work to testify. Mr. Towey, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Robert Towey. It's T-O-W-E-Y. I'm an independent contractor. I contract with Dart Transit, and I do pay taxes. I do have workman's comp. I have all the benefits that I choose to have. I'm self-employed. My name, my company is Towey Transport. I get a little resentful if people tell me that I don't pay taxes and I don't have medical and I'm deprived of this and that. And I don't have 62,000 members back in me or something. But I do have all the choices that I want to do in my business operation to pick loads, choose loads. If I want to work, don't want to work, I negotiate rates. I have a relationship with my bank, two banks. I purchase equipment. I look at myself as a small businessman. I would transport. But in the way that I feel like I'm under the gun to do something that I don't want to, and it's my company and I choose to do what I want. But I'm going to. Well, the risk of it, I have $105,000 in equipment, and I take in all the risk, the insurance. Like I said, I just put myself as self-employed,
All right,
and I pay taxes.
All right.
I pay taxes. I have medical.
Okay, very good, Mr. Is it Canilla? Sure. Again.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Canilla. That's C-A-N-I-L-L-A. I'd like to echo just about everything my partner has said. I am also a owner-operator. I invest in my equipment. Unfortunately, I do also pay taxes. I wish I didn't have to. I don't know how can anybody could say that an owner-operator doesn't pay taxes. I like to bring the records that my wife has at home and dispute that claim. I also have medical insurance. I am completely insured. It's my choice. I have been with the same company for 20 years. They do not have control over me. You may ask my dispatcher if who has control of my truck. If they offer me something that I am not ready to go or to do, I turn it down and they'll give me something else. Something else that was mentioned before was the exclusivity of pulling for a certain company. That's called a dedicated run in our business. I know many owner-operators that would kill get a dedicated run. That is the most efficient way of running a truck. You know where the customers are, where you deliver. You don't have to worry about finding the next place or it's a new place. You know the routes. You know where you can stop, where you can take your breaks. You've got the best food, let's put it that way. A dedicated run, if it's a good run with enough miles, is a dream come true for an owner-operator, not an hindrance. Other than that, that's all I have to say.
The truckers are always supposed to know where the best food is. Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and for one of our owner-operators, the other testifier, the audits that look like, at least to me in my opinion, that will run rampant with this bill, what is in one of those audits? If you don't want to disclose that on public record, I understand that too, but these audits that you'll be subject to in the bill, what do one of these cost you, you know, from a personal standpoint, from a business standpoint, as an industry, what does an audit from the state of Minnesota cost you?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. House,
I don't know the number. It tends to be on the motor carrier, not the independent contractor specifically. We can get you that information, but obviously it is costly. And I guess what we would say is this bill does require targeted audits right now at a time when the state budget is tight. And we would also say that it is not wise to be handcuffing agencies to determine what they're going to do. What we do know is there will be a cost to the agency to do it as well, and there will probably be a fiscal note to this bill.
Representative Silver.
Can I just ask one question? Mr. Canola, you said you worked for the company for 20 years. Are you free to be able to go to Hall for the company that you work for and also another company at the same time?
Mr. Canella.
No, I'm exclusively leased. My equipment is exclusively leased to the same company. I am able to terminate my lease contract and go to work with whoever I want to.
Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 813? Sir, please come to the table. Gentlemen, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state and spell your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Phil Raines, R-A-I-N-E-S, with Associated Builders and Contractors in Minnesota. And specifically here, I'm here speaking on behalf of our road contractors and our excavators. Every year we have to move equipment around the state. We have subcontractors. We have subcontractors to our subcontractors. We're afraid that this bill would disrupt our relationships that we have with our small business owner-operator contractors that move our equipment around. A lot of our guys have people in-house that do it and require people that can do surge capacity for them. Other people use these as a regular course of business to move their equipment around. They don't want to be in the business of trucking, but they have to truck their equipment around to get it to the sites that they're working. So that's our concern. So.
Thank you, Mr. Raines. Any questions to the testifier? Thank you very much, sir. Representative Johnson, if you'd return to the table. Representative Zellers.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be brief, and I do appreciate you giving the two gentlemen who came in the afternoon to speak now and rather than coming back at 4:30.
Of course.
Some other chairs haven't been so gracious, and I really do appreciate that. You should be complimented. Mr. Chairman, and we've been through this bill before, and unfortunately Representative Johnson didn't work with the groups, you know, in the interim, didn't do anything to reach out to them, didn't, say, what about this standard, what about that standard? And I had a meeting with a gentleman who is actually in his business is in my district, and
This isn't just about union versus non-union. He sent me an email because I wasn't sure of how many employees, but he has 200 union employees who work for his company. These folks are in a highly compact area, work area during the summer, during the construction season when they haul aggregate. Anybody who's been up in the Maple Grove area knows we got a couple of gravel pits up there. He said if we pass this bill, and again, Mr. Chair and members, this is what it's about right here. It's FedEx and the Teamsters. That's what this fight is about. It's not about the independent contractors, the couriers, the folks that we're defending here today. It's about this. The union and UPS, they want to get to FedEx. That's what it's about. This is what, again, my constituent, Mr. Johnson, said. It will not only cost him the 3 months, 4 months, half of maybe three-fourths, he doesn't know how much of the business in the summer, but it will also then cost him maybe as many as half of these union employees that he has working for him right now. Because when the construction companies want aggregate and when they need it for the construction season, those 200 trucks that he independently contracts to bring in that fill won't be available. And if he can't fill the load at that time, then maybe he won't be able to be the contractor of the day for that month for whatever road construction project is in the metropolitan area. So you're not only going to put union, non-union employees out of work, you're going to put union employees out of work with this bill. This wasn't hyperbole. He said, I'll tell you, I'm not a Democrat, Republican, union, non-union. He goes, I got a whole company full of union employees. We all get along great. He said, but we all agree this would kill our business. And we can go on and on. And I did take some of the phone calls. I sat in my office and listened, and I got emails after emails of what this bill would do. But the one thing that I heard from a number of these folks, whether they be small, independent couriers in outstate Minnesota or some of the bigger folks here in the metropolitan area, was what the bill does is actually, and it's over and over, and this isn't the solicited, the canned emails that we all get. These are all different. You can see the sizes, how many paragraphs or sentences or however many, how they're written. The one thing that comes up over and over and over again is that it absolutely introduces a lot more ambiguity. And these folks, in a time when they're looking to get jobs, when they're looking to actually have things to deliver, would put them in dire fear of new audits. And these folks, again, small business owners, you heard about the two gentlemen here who do pay taxes, just because it doesn't come in through the typical employer-employee relationship, doesn't mean you don't file quarterly taxes. And believe me, if you file those, I'm sure these guys will tell you, they're a lot more expensive than the ones that get taken out of your paycheck each week. But introducing ambiguity and then the threat of these audits coming in is, for a lot of these folks, and again, big, small, independent, in between, have said this could absolutely decimate our industry at a time, again, when our state's facing, let's be honest, it'll be a $6 billion deficit. This is the absolute wrong way to go with our economy in Minnesota, and especially to this industry. Again, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your deference and letting us committee go a little bit longer, but this is a big issue. It's a big jobs issue, not only for our state, for my district, for some of my constituents, but for many, many of yours in here as well, union and non-union. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Gonzalez. Mr. Reynoso, do you care to respond briefly, and then Representative Johnson, any closing comments?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I again want to be absolutely clear as far as our position. We are in no means, in no circumstances, looking to put a legitimate independent contractor out of business. If somebody is an independent contractor and is free from control, which many of the departments deem as a mitigating factor, if they are free from control of an employer, we have no problem with them whatsoever being an independent contractor. Again, there are 13.5 million of them, independent contractors nationwide. They're legitimate. We're not after those. We have absolutely no problem with them. Thank you.
President Johnson, any closing comments?
Just in summary, there is a huge problem in the local trucking courier industry. We know that from Deed. They've given us the general information on that. They have audited 30 of the 67 companies in Minnesota and found 35% misclassified. This is money that the state is losing out on. I mean, we're going to gain a lot more money by properly classifying people than worrying about money we're spending and actually auditing. So this is a benefit to the state of Minnesota, to the employees, to the state,
and to the companies that are playing by the rules. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. With that, the Chair moves, renews his motion, that House File 813 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Pritz, you've been quiet today. Were you taking time to review the minutes?
Certainly was, Chairman.
Would you please move the minutes of February 25th?
So moved.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We stand adjourned. Thank you all.